The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
The main character of Plug is dirty and disgusting, and there's a scene in this film and you see he's got his big mutton chops, he's wearing a hat, he's making these grunting sounds.
The terrible Australian B. Jemine.
Marcy, there's a scene for poor Barry McKenzie where French police shoot up an entire box of Foster's beer with machine guns.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
No, absolutely nothing. There's nothing there. This is shit. This is a shithole of a movie.
Mature themes.
I knew it was going to be a documentary about sex, but I thought it would be more about love and relationships and stuff like that. I didn't realise it was going to be about venereal diseases.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to episode 22 of the Ozploidcast, the podcast where my co-host Super Marcy and I take a deep dive into Australia's Ozploitation movement from the very beginning right up until today. And with me as always is my very Aussie-loving film co-host, and that, of course, is the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Hello, hello. Doing well, thanks, Speed. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thanks. Looking forward to today's episode of the show, because we have quite a collective of films for this one. It'll just be us today, which has been a little while since you and I have only just done an episode with just the two of us together. But I am looking forward to talking about all five of these films, because I feel like we'll have a lot to discuss.
Yeah, they are five kind of different films from each other. And strangely enough, there are two sequels.
Indeed, indeed. Like, this is, one is a sequel to a movie we have covered on the show quite a number of episodes back, while the other sequel is the follow-up to a movie we're also talking on this very episode as well.
So that's what makes this one kind of different and interesting, that we're discussing a sequel to a film that is in this episode, but also a sequel for a movie that was quite a number of episodes ago. So let's get straight to it, Bede.
Indeed.
What's on the menu today?
Indeed. Well, for this episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the film's initiation, Les Patterson Saves the World, Breaking Loose, Summer City 2, Day of the Panther, and Strike of the Panther. So we might as well get straight to it and discuss our very first film, which of course is the 1987 coming-of-age survival drama Initiation.
The dream again. Is this planning on a crash?
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We will shortly be landing in Adelaide, South Australia. Could you please make sure your customs declaration and arrival...
God, I've been on this plane for so long, I can't stay here any longer. I've never sat in one place in so long.
Where are you from?
I'm Brooklyn, New York. Thank you.
Warra is over there.
Which was directed by Michael Pierce, written by James Barton from an idea by Michael Pierce. This film stars Rodney Harvey, Bruno Lawrence, Miranda Otto, Anna Maria Winchester, Bobby Smith, and Tony Barry. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading off IMDb, is: after the death of his mother, Danny visits his father, Matt Malloy, whose farm has been going bad lately. So his father starts smuggling marijuana. When Danny joins him on one of his flights, Danny soon finds himself Alone. Now, of course, this is a coming-of-age survival drama that, honestly, I have to admit, Marcy, when I first heard of this movie back in the day, I automatically assumed it was a horror film.
I can see why. I mean, even just from, like, the artwork for this film, and particularly the DVD release, at least, because it's in front of me right now, so I'm looking at it, and it does look like kind of a horror movie.
Yeah, exactly. And I assumed for the longest time that it was, but it wasn't until I actually read more into it and then realized, oh, this is actually more of a survival drama thriller. But then when you actually sit down to watch it, the actual survival part of the movie really doesn't come into play until the last 40 minutes of the movie. And then the previous 50 minutes is literally this story of this young man who comes to Australia to meet his father. So there's a bit of that sort of coming of age story there. But then it also switches gears and becomes sort of a drug mule story as well. So there's definitely a lot going on in this one, but I'm kind of curious to hear what you think, Marcy. What did you think of Initiation?
Yeah, like with a number of films that we have covered and more than likely will cover, there are a lot that I haven't heard of, or the name may sound familiar, but I don't know anything about it. And this was one I had no idea about it at all until getting to this episode and to watch it. So I didn't know what it was. I just went into it and I enjoyed this film for the most part. The problem I think with this film, and this is what you mentioned just before, is that it's a film of many different things and it's not quite sure what it's aiming to be. At a point in the film, it's a kind of coming of age story for the character of Danny, who I'm assuming meant to be a teenager or late teenager, going to find his Australian dad, and his dad has a farm, and as it says in the synopsis, it's not going that great, so he resorts to smuggling marijuana. Then it becomes a father-son bonding film, but then it's also a drug smuggling film, and then it becomes an outback sort of survival film. All the while, they still need to, I guess, protect the drugs, the money, or whichever that there is. So it's all sorts of things. And I think that's the issue. If it was clear on what it actually wanted to be, it would have worked a lot better. If it stuck to being this father-son bonding film with a survival film without the needless other stuff put in there, I think it would have fared a lot better. But it just goes from one thing to the other while still doing the other things. It's a little all over the place in that regard, but I still think it was an interesting and enjoyable watch. I quite enjoyed the performances in the film. I liked our main young man, the American Danny, played by Rodney Harvey. I thought he made for a pretty good lead. And of course, baby Miranda Otto is in the film, and she's, I guess, the stepdaughter of the father character. Definitely notable for being a very early performance from her as well. And I think it's shot pretty nicely. There's definitely some really good sweeping scenes in it. I just think its biggest downfall is that it's trying to be too many things.
Actually, this was her second movie. So there you go. Because her first was a film called Emma's War. So this is very much the very beginning of Miranda Otto's career. And I got to say, Marty, I thought this movie was okay. I think sort of the mixture of trying to be so many different things all at once just came off as rather jarring to me as a viewer. I will admit, I think the first half, where it does kind of settle on this sort of coming of age story between this New York kid and his dad, to me was the more effective part of the story.
I mean, we all should add, it is a fish out of water story as
indeed,
well.
Indeed. And so it has all these elements in it. And like, I think if they were kind of their own separate thing, like in their own separate movie, I would think these particular ideas would work really well. But I think when you kind of mash them all together, like I say, it does feel uneven in terms of its story structure and it going from one thing to the other. Because of that, I wasn't as engaged with it as I could have been, since it does switch gears every so often. And now, usually with most films, I can be on board with that. And I love a movie that kind of, you think it's going to be one thing at the beginning, but then it kind of goes a completely different direction as it goes along. But I feel like in this case, though, it doesn't really quite work. And I feel like it's kind of confused about what type of film it wants to be. And that being said, though, I think the performances are pretty strong. I think everyone does a pretty good job. And I really like the relationship between the characters of Daddy and his father, Nat. And I think both Rodney Harvey and Bruno Lawrence give really strong performances there. And also the supporting cast is also good as well, like Miranda Otto, Anna Maria Winchester, Tony Barry, who we've discussed on this show before, and also Bobby Smith, who plays the role of Kulu, who is this indigenous man who lives on Daddy's father's property. And he sort of becomes kind of like this surrogate figure to Danny.
He's almost like a mentor-ish character. And I think, yeah, his character is one of the stronger aspects of the film. He plays an interesting and engaging character that you don't get enough of, I think, in the film.
Yeah, like, I think he does a really good job, and he kind of tells Danny about how to survive in the outback, and also he kind of, in a way, is able to communicate with Danny psychically while he and his father are lost in the bush in the second half. So,
yeah, not the only film we'll be discussing where something like that happens.
Indeed. But, yeah, and it doesn't surprise me at all, because, like, looking up Bobby Smith, who plays Kulu, he actually got an actor award nomination for Best Supporting Actor for this film, which I think is pretty well deserved. Because, like you say, he is very memorable in this film. It's a movie where I feel like the sum of the parts are definitely better than the whole. The performances are strong. There are definitely some really interesting and compelling ideas and story threads in it. But I think when you kind of mash all these different types of plots together, it just doesn't really quite work as well as it could have.
Yeah, I think because it seems very muddled about what sort of movie it wants to be, even what genre it really wants to be. I think, yeah, that's what harms it, but there's interesting ideas, there's good characters. It just doesn't quite come together as well as it should. Again, in saying that, I did enjoy it. There's stuff to like in it. I just don't think it really came together the way it probably should have, I think.
Definitely. I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of Initiation. And Marcy, your final thoughts overall on the film and also your rating out of 5 for it.
Yeah, I gave this one 3.5 out of 5, which might seem bizarre considering what I've said about it, but I did quite enjoy it. And I guess it's called Initiation, and you can take that in any kind of way, but I feel like it's him kind of being initiated into living in the outback and that way of life. I don't know, if I'm wrong, tell me, which is all good. It does suffer, as we keep saying, that it's trying to do too many things. Even with that said, I found enjoyment in it. It's like, okay, now we're doing marijuana smuggling. Like, what's going on? But yeah, I just found it overall enjoyable, different, if somewhat flawed.
Yeah, I think for me, I'm going to give this about a 2.5 out of 5. Like I say, it's a bit all over the place in terms of its story, and its structure does feel rather sluggish because of that. And also, there are definitely some elements in it that also didn't work for me. I feel like Anna Maria Winchester, who plays Sal, Danny's father's new wife, I don't feel like she's really given that much to do in the movie. And whenever she does appear on screen, the way the character is portrayed, it just came off as rather confused, if that makes any sense, because it's like almost as if they didn't know what to do with this character, so they tried to make her be one thing. She basically changes personalities from one scene to the next, which was very odd. But Miranda Otto is quite good. I really enjoyed her in the film, and both, like I said, Rodney Harvey and Bruno Lawrence are also good as well. And it's beautifully shot by Jeffrey Simpson. And I agree with the assessment what you were saying just before about what the title of Initiation can mean, because you can see it as almost like this whole, what happens to Danny throughout this film, and particularly in the last half, could be his initiation from being a boy into a man. So you could definitely read that into it, but I kind of wish you kind of dived into that a little bit more. So we'll move right along to our next film, which is the 1987 comedy Les Patterson Saves the World.
He's Australia's ambassador to the United Nations.
Give me speech, Master. Give me speech.
A man with charm. Charisma.
I've never done it with a repulsive man before.
And dignity.
I've had a couple of drinks, as a matter of fact, but I've still got control of my faculties.
He has a way with words.
We got more culture than a penicillin factory.
With the press.
I've got the media up the freckle.
And with the ladies.
Just what we call the kangaroo position.
But when Les blows away Australia's international credibility...
My deep shit. I think you'll need a snorkel.
He has no way of avoiding the consequences.
I have fired him, Madam President.
Fire him, asshole. Promote him.
You're our new man in the Middle East. How about that?
On arrival, Les doesn't quite get the reception he anticipated.
Prepare the camel's medication.
But just as Les recovers from his brush with death, he stumbles upon a sinister plot to destroy the world.
Nothing must stop us now.
With the help of Possums for Peace delegate Dame Edna Everidge.
You third world perverts!
And with a lot of encouragement from French lab assistant Veronique.
But you did it very badly.
Let's try it again.
Sir Les embarks on his most demanding mission yet.
Try to get it right, Les.
International megastar Dame Edna.
You unwholesome perverts!
Pamela Stevenson.
How do you like me so far?
And Australia's very own hero, star in the outrageously funny and irreverent comedy, Les Patterson Saves the World.
No worries.
Which is directed by George T. Miller. No, not that George Miller. Another Australian director who happens to also be named George Miller, but hence the T in the middle. Written by Barry Humphries and Diane Milstead. This film stars Barry Humphries, Pamela Stevenson, Theo Fengus, and if I butchered your name, please forgive me, Andrew Clark, Henri Sims, Hugh Keyes-Byrne, Garth Ede, John Clark, and Joan Rivers. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading off IMDb once again, is a boozy Australian diplomat's disastrous UN appearance lands him in the Middle East, where he stumbles into a KGB bioweapon. With the help of Dame Edna, this perpetually drunk mess must accidentally become the world's unlikeliest hero. Now, as you all know, Les Patterson is a character who was created by Australian comedian Barry Humphries, who, of course, for most of our listeners out there, is probably best known as also being the creator and also star of Dame Edna Everidge. So during this time, Barry Humphries was kind of at the top of his game in terms of being a success overseas as a comedian. So he decided, as kind of like, I guess you would say, a long-awaited follow-up to the Barry McKenzie films, which we discussed very early on this show, since that was also creations made by him as well, to create a new comedy. So he decided to make this film centered around his Australian politician character, Les Patterson. So the question is, though, what did we think of this film? And Marcy, what are your thoughts on Les Patterson Saves the World?
Yeah, so honestly, going into this film, I actually expected worse than what it is. But, you know, this isn't a good film by any means. It honestly doesn't have much of a story. The character of Les Patterson isn't really pleasant to be around most of the time. And as a comedy, it is really hit and miss, but I think it misses more than it hits. Like, at least for me, I feel like Dame Edna was probably a better character to base it around, because at least she's kind of a fully fleshed character. There are genuinely funny moments in the film. Like, I laughed out loud at this scene where Les Patterson kicks a guy and his shoe gets stuck in his bum. Has to walk around with like one shoe, and then they remove this from, like, things like that that'll slapstick silly work in this film. The part where they're in the spinning restaurant and it just goes batshit insane, like, that stuff I found genuinely really funny. The fact that Joan Rivers, for whatever reason, appears in the film as the President of the United States is a great choice. And she didn't care. She was just doing what she was doing, and it's great. I just feel it's definitely let down by everything else around it. And I don't think the intention was for it to, like, not really work. They obviously wanted something that was going to be funny, slapstick, being a satire. But again, it suffers from what a lot of Australian comedy had suffered from. And we've definitely discussed this on other episodes. It's very, in a nasty way, I guess, very sexist.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like maybe to a less extent of it being nasty, it's very racist in a lot of ways. And I don't mean to be funny about it. That said, I honestly expected it to probably be worse than what it was. So in that respect, it didn't focus too much on being offensive in that way, but there's enough there that it's like, really? With all that said, I'd rather watch Les Patterson Saves the World over something like Pacific Banana again. and this isn't the film that I disliked the most on this episode even. And all that said, I have to give props to just one of the silliest performances in this movie by Thaur Penglis.
Yes.
And I apologize if I said that wrong. And I best well known him from playing Tony DiMera on Days of Our Lives. And I was like, wait a minute, I know who that is. And that just kind of blew me away for that fact. I'm like, oh shit, okay. He absolutely doesn't, like, he knows what this film is. He knows what he's doing. And I think, like, at least on his part, it's one of the better performances. But I'll say this as well. Cue his burn as Inspector Farouk. It's a little, I'm not outright saying it, but it's a little bit of something face in there. So just we'll go with that. But he commits to the character, and the directions that this character goes into are unexpected, but he's all in. And I appreciate that, despite the fact, yeah, there's a little bit of inappropriate face going on. But I digress. We know it's Australia. It's in the 80s. Mm. I'm not excusing that by any means, but that said, I can appreciate what he put into that performance.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And it also, as we sort of stated before, especially with films, especially comedy films like this, they were made in a very specific time. And it's not where we don't excuse those things. We definitely acknowledge them, but we also have to remember the context of the time where they sort of happened. Like, obviously, if this film was made today, none of that stuff would be in it. But
it'd
be a
very different movie.
Oh,
with
yeah.
Three different probably problems with it, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it wouldn't be the only film, like at least a film like this made at this time that also did these type of things as well. I could even think of it like American films or British films were doing this as well. So it seems like it was a very different time. But
yeah. And it doesn't, by any means, we're not excusing that. We say it's there. But at the same time, I don't know the people who made this personally. And if something's good, I'll acknowledge it's good. If something's shit, I'll definitely say it's shit.
Yeah, definitely.
So, anyway, your thoughts, Bee.
Yeah, well,
you'd seen this before, right? Because I feel like I'd only seen clips of his existence, but I had not seen the whole thing.
Well, this was my second time watching it. I remember the first time seeing it maybe a couple years ago, maybe about 10 odd years ago. At the time, I really didn't like it. Now, rewatching it again in prep for this show, it definitely is not a good movie, and I agree with you with that, but there are definitely elements of it where you can definitely see, like, oh, there's a better movie in there somewhere, but it's just surrounded by all the stuff that just doesn't work about it. I definitely agree with you. I'm not sure what possessed Barry Humphries to want to make a film centered around the Les Patterson character. Like, obviously, I was already fully aware of this character before I even saw the film, because again, it's one of the iconic characters that he has played. But I don't know if he's strong enough as a character to build a whole film around. Like, you could definitely see, like, Barry Humphries wanted to make something in the vein of the Barry McKenzie films, because as you and I both know, Barry McKenzie as a character in those films definitely shares some similar traits to Les in this film. He loves a drink, to be a womanizer. But I feel like with that film, there's something about Barry McKenzie as a character that kind of, I guess you could say, like, there was something likable about him.
I feel he's sort of an endearing character because, like, Barry McKenzie is not the most clued in person, and it works. But Les Patterson, it's kind of like mocking politicians as a character, like being a drunkard, womanizing, whatever. But I just don't think it really works, like, at all.
Yep.
And I don't know if it's true, but Barry Humphries didn't like how this film turned out, wasn't a fan, was embarrassed by it, I think. Whether that's true, I'm not sure, but I'm just going by what I've read.
And I can understand that for sure, because I feel like he tried to replicate the success of Barry McKenzie for this film, but it doesn't quite hit the mark. I don't know whether it was because the script wasn't strong enough or some of the ideas weren't fully formed. Or it could be also another thing too, like, because George T. Miller, who directed this film, he's such an odd choice to direct a film like this. Because if you look at all of his other films that he has made, like even prior to this, because he directed The Man from Snowy River. But after this film, he would direct The Neverending Story 2, The Next Chapter, as well as family films like Andre, Zeus and Roxanne, and a mixture of TV films as well. Making a comedy as broad as this maybe not have been in his wheelhouse. Because honestly, at times though, watching this film, it felt like it was channeling sort of like Philippa Mora energy throughout. And there were times, like, if you told me he directed this film rather than George T. Miller, I would have probably believed you. Because it just felt like watching either the return of Captain Invincible or Howling Free once again. Like, it kind of has that sort of same tone. But yeah, it kind of just feels off. That's not to say there aren't legit amusing moments throughout. And I do love the scene with the rotating restaurant, because that is such a great sequence.
It's just so stupid. And it's like, because there's like all sorts of like the characters coming in there and stuff, and there's stupid little throwaway, like, wink moments. Like, I think it's the Russians have booked under the name Humphreys. Like, oh, well, okay. We get the reference to Barry Humphreys. But yeah, it's just so over the top and silly that it is one of the funnier things. Like, when it leans into just being very slapstick silly, I think it works better in that regard. And again, I don't know if this is true. This is just on IMDb, but apparently George T. Miller really liked this movie.
Yeah, I think I read that as well, and it said it was one of his favorite films that he directed. So it's kind of interesting, like, he would say that while Humphries, on the other hand, was embarrassed by the film. So it's kind of interesting that they had that kind of different perspectives on this film. But I will say, though, to me, where this film is its strongest is when it focuses on Dame Edna. Because as you and I both know, Dame Edna Etheridge is an icon. She is a beloved figure. And I'm kind of surprised that this movie isn't more centered around her, because I think the idea of Dame Edna Etheridge, this fabulous little old lady from Moonee Ponds, who her Possums for Peace group come to this sort of Middle Eastern country. She's also an undercover spy for the US CIA. For me, that sounds like a much more fun idea for a story.
It's more like when you have like Dame Edna with the possums, and it's just so ridiculous. And all of it is just so silly, but at least there's something there. Like, even the joke with the bloody giving the colonel the koala.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck? It's so random and stupid, but like, that's the stuff that kind of works more. Yeah, so I was going to bring up that this film was, I think, one of the biggest box office flops in this country. It did not do well. It was a massive, massive flop. I think it was Hoyts distributed it in Australia. And I don't think he was Prime Minister at the time, but he was in Parliament in something. Paul Keating was just so appalled by this movie. But I also want to bring up that there's a virus in the film, and it's so over the top and gross, but it's obviously meant to sort of be like a commentary on AIDS. And yeah, it's in poor taste because that's what it's doing. But I feel like the interesting part of the commentary they're making is about how there's this virus, but there is an antidote, but they're not going to give it to you. They want to start something bad and then be like, oh, well, here, you can buy the cure and stuff. I think that's more of an interesting thing to add in there. And funnily enough, and maybe we'll get hate for this, a lot of people seem to think that's what actually happened a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And also, what I find interesting too, because again, I was doing some more research on this film. Apparently, before George T. Miller was given the job to direct the film, Barry Humphries went to Brian Trenchard-Smith to direct it. And apparently, Brian Trenchard-Smith turned it down because he felt like the whole sort of help virus, which, as you stated before, is kind of a satirizing the AIDS epidemic, felt in poor taste to him, so he turned it down. So I could definitely see that for sure, and I don't blame him because, and it kind of also shows that Brian Trenchard-Smith, like how much of a great director and person he is. Like, even if something is satirizing something, it's like, yeah, I don't think it's kind of a good idea to kind of satirize this big
Yeah, and we know
epidemic
that
that's
like
happening.
Brian Trenchard-Smith can make a good and not really offensive and wrong documentary about venereal diseases, so.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of interesting things about this film, but again, it doesn't quite work. And it doesn't really have that sort of, even though it kind of has similar elements to the Barry McKenzie films in terms of
It's
like.
yeah, it's just it doesn't hit the same, and I think that's definitely to do with like Les Patterson as a character, as well as just a flim-flam, what the fuck is this story even half the time?
Exactly. But I guess that could be a wrap on our discussion of Les Patterson Saves the World, and Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this film.
Yeah, I give this one to getting your shoe lost in somebody's bum out of five. Such a stupid gag, but oh my God, it made me laugh. Yeah, I think it's not a good movie. It has its moments, but it has so many issues. And yeah, I mean, again, I was expecting worse. That surprised me the most. The fact that I can be like, this isn't the one I disliked the most on this episode. And we'll get to that in the next movie.
Well, I'm going to give this also a 2 out of 5 as well. Like you say, there are definitely some amusing moments throughout, and there's definitely fun elements. Like, I think the supporting cast definitely go all in on their performances. And yes, some characters are definitely questionable, and there's definitely some racism and a few other things in there as well, which definitely by today's standards is problematic. But I feel like for me, at the end of the day, compared to, again, even though I don't want to keep comparing this film back to the Barry McKenzie films, but it's the only comparison I could make, is like, I feel like the humor kind of misses the mark more so. And also, I think Les Patterson as a character, as you say, isn't as endearing as Barry McKenzie. So I feel like for me personally, the film is at its strongest when Dame Edna is on screen, because you can definitely tell that Barry Humphries feels, I guess, more comfortable in the Dame Edna persona. And because also Dame Edna has great wit about her as well. So most of her one-liners are pretty hilarious. And I just think the idea of Dame Edna as an undercover spy seems more entertaining to me as a viewer than Les Patterson going to a Middle Eastern country and getting caught up in this kind of plot between the Russians and other countries as well. So to me, that sounds more fun as a premise. So it should have been called Dame Edna Saves the World, damn it. So yeah, 2 out of 5 for me. So we'll move right along to our third film, which is the first of our two sequels for this episode. And it is the sequel to the 1977 film Summer City, which we discussed quite a number of episodes back, with the 1988 film Breaking Loose, Summer City 2.
Wait on, wait. Leave on the run. more bloody trouble again.
He's Ross Cameron, and he's running for his life.
Don't preach to me.
Now, this is my town as much as his or anyone else's.
Great. And I'll handle my problems my way.
But can he handle the pressure?
I know things are tough for you at the moment.
Breaking loose is the only way out.
Just remember, if it happens again, I'll stick your dick in fiberglass.
Romance, revenge, and high adventure. Starring Peter Phelps as Ross Cameron.
Hey!
With Vince Martin as Robbie, a friend to even the odds.
Sprung. We were about to have our morning snort.
Also starring Abigail as Helen, a complication he doesn't need. And introducing David Numingjara as Davy.
Sit down, weasel!
He's gone crazy!
With music from Dear Enemy, Living Fast and Dying Young is Breaking Loose.
Which was written and directed by Rod Hay. And this film stars Peter Phelps, Vince Martin, Abigail, Shane Connor, John Clayton, and David Nurungnabara. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading off IMDb, is a directionless Australian teen who finds his life spiraling more quickly than he can handle, makes an impulsive escape to the Australian coast to stay with a friend of his mother's. But it doesn't take long for him to realize that the questionable adults around him appear to be in need of a similar awakening. Now, as we sort of stated before, this is, I guess, the long-awaited sequel to Summer City.
Who was waiting for a sequel to Summer City?
Well, we do have to remember, Marcy, even though when we did talk about Summer City quite a number of episodes back, we do have to remember at the time the movie actually did quite well at the box office. So I guess Philip Avalon, who started the original film and also produced it and also comes back to produce this one as well, since this whole series of films is his baby, I guess he wanted to make a sequel to that film. Yeah, it finally arrived in the form of Breaking Loose, which does share some characters. Some characters who appeared in the original film do show up in this one as well, but it mostly centers upon Peter Phelps's character, Ross. But the question is, though, did we think this was better, worse, or just as Summer City? So, Marcy, your thoughts on Breaking Loose Summer City 2?
Well, I'll tell you that right now. Yeah, I think this manages to be slightly better than Summer City, not by much. And as you mentioned, characters from the first film appear in this one, but they're all recast. The only returning person is Abigail, and she was barely in Summer City as is. She's got more of a role in this one, and I think she's fine in it. Again, I don't know why a sequel was made, because I don't feel like this offers anything new, and it doesn't really add anything. Like, it's just kind of there. I think, look, there's some decent performances. I think Peter Phelps is a fine lead. Like, he's definitely got the charisma. Yeah, some of the other performances, I think, are decent, as well as David Nurungdabara, I thought was pretty good. Definitely a standout, and I think this was his film debut the same year he was in something else that I can't remember.
Oh, I believe it was Young Einstein.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that checks out. Yeah. So he had quite a debut year because there was a lot of sequels coming out at this point. Crocodile Dundee 2, Return to Snowy River. Yeah, so there's some decent performances, but I think what I got to talk about with this movie, there's a bikey gang that for whatever fucking reason are harassing Peter Phelps' character for the whole movie, that they feel so out of place in this film. And they're like, they're straight out of like Mad Max, the Road Warrior, like in how they look and act, but they added personality to this film, which it was lacking a lot. I can't recommend either of the films because they're just not great. But this one, I feel like it's slightly better. I think it's paced a little better. And I think at least because we're focusing sort of more on the Ross character and his little journey, whatever that really is, makes it a bit better. I don't know. But I think the standout performance already, I mentioned one. The second one is Shane Connor, a.k.a. Joe Scully from Neighbours as the leader of the weird fucking bikey gang. He was in a completely different movie, and it adds personality to something that is really kind of dull. And then just how this movie ends, like, the Peter Phelps character cannot throw a Molotov cocktail to save his life. He ends up smashing this into Shane Connor's, like, Jeep or whatever he's driving, and then it just smashes into the friend's, like, surfboard shop. So he just destroyed everything for no reason. There's a guy burning alive in the car, and then they're just like, oh, let's go swimming. Like, what the fuck was that? I don't know if I can really add anything else, because there's nothing really going on in this film. Honestly, I think something like this, it would have benefited if this was something like Ross, not dealing with like bikies or something, but just wanting to discover who he is. And add in the surfing, you could have had something that was like Wind Riders, exploring a romantic relationship while also exploring yourself. But this just doesn't explore anything. What is this movie? It's not good, that's for sure. It says a lot when I would probably watch Les Patterson Saves the World over this.
Yeah, well, I have to admit, Marcy, I did like this one better than the first Summer City, because I will admit, though, I probably like this one just a little bit more than you, but for different reasons. Like, there's definitely more of a what the fuck type of element to this movie every now and again, like you say.
It's with the bikers. They added these bikers in. It's like, these guys give this movie personality.
Marcy, they're not just bikers. They're bikers out of a Mad Max film. That's
but
what
they're
they...
not. They look like they are out of a Mad Max film. You can't, there's no other way to describe it. Whatever you think a bikie gang looks like in Australia, this is not what they're portraying at all.
Like, it's funny though, like, if these characters were in Dead End Drive-In, I wouldn't bat an eye.
Exactly.
We saw characters similar to this in Run, Chrissy, Run. But even then, I didn't really bat an eye for that one. But I bat more of an eye for this one. It's like, you guys feel like you are in a completely different movie. And Shane Connor's performance, you can definitely tell he is trying to channel the character of Toe Cutter in
Oh, 100%.
Because there were times like, I can see you're trying to channel a bit of a Hugh Keyes bird in this performance, Shane Connor. I know exactly what you're doing. But I think what's interesting though, like, because knowing that this is a sequel to Summer City, I was like, okay, I knew Abigail was in this film and she's reprising her role as her minor character of the older woman in the bar, who I do remember in that episode, I did praise her performance there because she basically gave a talk down to one of the biggest idiots in that film. So she's back here, and I think she's really good in this film. And I didn't realize that Vince Martin, who plays the role of Robbie, that's the character that Philip Avalon played in the original film. So there's kind of that connection there. And also, Ross is the son of Boo, who Steve Bisley played in the original. He was the character who died at the end of the film. So it wasn't until I read up while watching the movie and also a bit more afterwards that, like, oh yeah, those are the characters. But I think what's interesting though is, like, even if you haven't seen Summer City,
oh, you can watch this without having seen it, because I think it fills you in on enough that you need to know easily.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, it works as a standalone as well. And I know in some places the movie was just released as Breaking Loose, so that way it doesn't really have those ties to the original. And I do agree. I think even in his first film, David Nrungnabara does a great job. And it doesn't surprise me after this film, he would get nominated for an actor award 3 times and won all 3 awards, which is awesome. Also, I got to say this, Marcy, I kind of had an idea what movie I was going into, because is it just me or the opening credits to this movie with Peter Phelps dancing around, getting ready to go to a party, feels like a commercial for a deodorant?
It does. It's a deodorant commercial. Well, I will say it's a weird, like, opening, but you got to kind of love that. And what I liked is the choice of song at the beginning of the film. It was like setting me up for a movie that was going to be better than what it was. So I was a bit disappointed with that. But There are interesting choices, but yeah, just for me, it does not work whatsoever.
And also, like Initiation, this is kind of trying to be also a coming of age film with Ross trying to find himself, especially.
But he kind of feels almost too old.
Yeah, well, looking it up, Peter Phelps was actually 27 at the time when he made this film. So even watching this film, it's like, dude, you're a little too old to be playing a teenager.
I mean, that said, I think he's fine in the role. I've always thought he's a good actor. I'm trying to think, what was the show that he was really well known for? Was it Stingers?
Yes, it was Stingers, but he was also in Sons and Daughters, A Contractors. Yes. He was also a Baywatch as well. Yeah, but I think it was really Stingers that was probably his best known show for sure.
Yeah, I feel like Stingers was a big one.
But he's been in a lot of stuff.
He's been in heaps of stuff. Yeah, he's like briefly in, like, is that at the end of Point Break?
I believe he was the Aussie surfer at the end of Point Break.
Yeah. Like, anyway.
I like to imagine that's the Ross character in Point Break.
It totally was. It's actually just Ross. He was so happy after burning someone alive.
Exactly. But I guess that could be a wrap on our discussion of Breaking Loose, Summer City 2. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this movie?
Yeah, I give this, it's 2, this bikey gang is insane, out of 5. For me, yeah, it's slightly better, I think, than Summer City, but not by too much. It's something that really did not gel with me for the most part. Yeah, and this was the one I liked the least out of all these movies we've done for this particular episode, but I will take Breaking Loose over Pacific Banana or Plug, though, so there you go.
I'm actually going to be slightly more generous, and I'm going to give this about a 2.5 out of 3, because there were definitely some more characters in this one who were definitely a bit more likable compared to Summer City, and also the kind of, like Initiation, it's also trying to be so many different things at once, but I found how it approaches it a bit more hilarious here, because you got the Mad Max biker element, you have the sort of the action film element, and we even have like a domestic violence element as well with Abigail and her dickhead husband.
Why the fuck are you with this guy? You could easily bury him in the backyard and no one would notice. Fucking hell.
Exactly. And also there are definitely some pretty solid performances in there as well. I did have to laugh with the fact that you had Shane Cotter basically crash into the Robbie's like house with all the surfboards. It blows up and he's literally burning alive inside, and everyone's like going, oh, let's go surfing.
Yeah, like what the hell was that ending?
So yeah, I give this one about a 2.5 out of 5. Now we'll move right along to our next film, which is the 1988 direct-to-video martial arts film Day of the Panther.
Ancient society of the Panthers stands a fighter highly skilled in the art of hand-to-hand combat, karate. A warrior trained beyond the limits of any mortal man. Jason Blade, a 3-time world karate champion, is an agent out to hunt the killer who murdered his partner. Are against him, but to get even, he has to fight through a trail of martial artists and deadly assassins until finally he comes face to face with the killer in a showdown where only the champion comes out alive.
Which was directed by a director who we have talked about a lot on this show, which of course is Brian Trenchard-Smith. written by Peter West from a story by Peter West and David Groom. This film stars Edward John Starzak, John Statton, Jim Richards, Michael Carmen, Zale Daniel, Matthew Quatermain, and Paris Jefferson. And the plot summary for this film, which I'm reading off IMDb, is a martial arts expert goes after a criminal gang and its boss who were responsible for the death of his partner. Now, this is one of two direct-to-video action films that Brian Trenchard Smith directed for the home market. And you're probably wondering, but wasn't Brian Trenchard Smith making like cinema releases around his time? Why is he making a couple of direct-to-video action films? There's a good reason for that, because he actually came in at the very last minute to direct both of these films, because both these films, which were shot back to back, had a completely different director. The producers weren't happy with what they were seeing from the footage, so they hired a more experienced director, in their words, to come in and take over the film. And literally, Brian Trenchard Smith had at least 2 days of prep to work on the film, and basically just went straight into it, reshot a few things, rewrote some of the script, and even brought in new actors in the role. Like the character of William Anderson, played by John Statton, he was actually brought in by Brian Trenchard Smith in his role as a recast. So I have heard of Day of the Panther for a while now, but the question is, Marcy, what did you think of Day of the Panther? Because I know you love your good old-fashioned, low-budget, direct-to-video martial arts film.
I do. Definitely right up my alley. But what did I think of this one? Look, I think it's mostly a fun and enjoyable film. The bright spots, really, for this are the fight scenes and action scenes. They're done really, really well. And I think most of the cast are pretty good in their roles as well. And I think you can tell that someone else was brought in to finish this, because the film as a whole, and what lets it down really, is it's just all over the place. The pacing is so all over the place. It takes itself a little too serious. I don't think this really embraced how silly it could be. And in no offense at all to Edward John Starzak, don't think he was quite a fully engaging lead. And it's hard to say what that could be, because in action scenes, martial arts scenes, yeah, perfect. I just don't know if he had the charisma to pull off this kind of character. But yeah, it's got flaws. It's got obvious flaws. But I think this is, for me, like an easy Sunday afternoon, put on a movie and relax kind of thing. It has its good points, it has its down points, but I think the things that work and are enjoyable, I think, elevated a little bit more. It wasn't great, but it wasn't terrible either. That's the best way I can put it.
Well, personally, I enjoyed it myself, because like you, I enjoy good old-fashioned, low-budget martial arts films. So this movie kind of hit all the marks for me. But I do think, though, what makes this film as fun as it is because of Brian Trenchard Smith. I feel like he brought such an energy to it. And I think the fight scenes, which were also actually choreographed by co-stars Edward John Starzak and Jim Richards, were actually really well done. I'm not saying they're the most amazing action martial arts scenes ever done, but they're pretty solid, though.
Yeah, no, they're really well done, and you got to give credit, because martial arts scenes aren't always the easiest to get down, but I think here it's done really, really well. And I think you can feel the Brian Trenchard Smith, like, parts of the film where it's more interesting and engaging, because I feel like this probably would have been quite dull if he didn't step in. And there are definitely parts that slow the film down, but it's also just very, for me, it was just too convoluted as a plot. And I'll speak about how Strike of the Panther does things when we get to that soon. But yeah, for me, it was a mixed bag, but I think there's more good to get out of it.
Oh yeah, definitely. And I do agree with you. I do think it takes itself maybe a little too seriously, and it can be quite muddled at times. But I think, again, the mixture of its direction in action set pieces and some of the supporting cast do elevate it. Edward Starzak, I do agree with you. He definitely is rather wooded. And this is around the time when, why cast actors and train them to be martial artists when we could just cast martial artists and teach them how to act? So I didn't think he was too bad, but I could definitely see he did come across as rather wooded. at times. Although I have to say, I feel like the parts that stood out to me the most, I wouldn't be surprised did have involvement from Brian Trenchard-Smith, particularly in the scene where Jason Blay, which is a great name for a character, by the way, his partner, Linda, who is Anderson's daughter, she is in Perth trying to track down the bad guys. And then she runs into a gang who all wear these like weird masks. And they feel like something out of a Mad Max film.
I mean, they felt like they were the kidnappers from Fortress.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I thought that all the sequences with them were actually pretty good. And again, you do feel some intensity in these ones, especially because you got this one character going up against all of them. But also the movie does have its tendency to be rather bizarre at times, like the gym seduction scene where basically the character of Jason, he is working out. Throughout the course of the film, he meets Gemma, played by Paris Jefferson, who is Anderson's niece, and there's definitely obvious attraction there. So she tries to seduce him by doing a dance in the gym while he's working out on weights. And I'm not gonna lie, Marcy, I was laughing so hard throughout this entire scene.
It comes out of nowhere and it doesn't feel in tone with anything in the movie. But it's hilarious. It's like, what am I watching right now? Yep, no, he's pumping iron. She's like, I'm just going to do a sexy dance for you around the gym. It's like, what the fuck is happening?
Exactly. And that to me kind of felt like something out of an Andy Sidaris film for some bizarre reason.
That was very Andy Sidaris style.
Yeah, like I will admit, there are definitely moments in here where it did have that sort of Andy Sidaris energy, but it didn't quite reach it. However, though, when we get to our next film, I feel like that felt even more prevalent in that one. But we'll get to it shortly, though. But
yeah,
I guess I could be a wrap on this discussion of Day of the Panther. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating overall on this film?
Yeah, I give this one 3 out of 5. I think, like I said, it's a fun and enjoyable film. I think it needed to embrace being silly more than it is, and it has parts of being very muddled and confused, but there's definitely some good stuff in there. Again, the action martial arts scenes are definitely the highlight of this one.
Yeah, I'm gonna give it a 3 out of 5 as well. It does take itself a little too seriously, and the story can be a little hard to follow in points, but I think when the movie shines, it really shines and does embrace the kind of the silliness that it wants to. And I do chalk that up to Brian Trenchard-Smith, because we have discussed him a lot on this show. And when he does do that, you can definitely tell that is all him. And I think the martial arts sequences are pretty solid. And I was entertained. And like you say, it's an easy breezy watch as well. If you're a fan of these type of films, especially from this period, I think you'll enjoy this one as well. So we'll move on to our fifth and final film for this episode, which happens to be the sequel to Day of the Panther, mainly because, well, obviously they were shot back to back, but that's beside the point. So we'll go straight into its sequel, Strike of the Panther.
Jason Blade is back. He's sharper. He's tougher. He's hotter. He's deadlier than ever before. A killer has returned to settle an old score. Mentor is in trouble. His lover is in danger. And a city is at risk. Is back to face his ultimate challenge. Strike of the Panther, the deadliest strike of all.
Which, once again, was directed by Brian Trenchard-Smith, written by Peter West. And once again, this film stars Edward John Starlecks, John Statton, Jim Richards, Paris Jefferson, Zale Daniel, Matthew Quatermain, and this time, Rowena Wallace. And the plot summary for this sequel is, once again, I'm reading off IMDb, martial arts and cop Jason Blade must venture into a volatile chemical plant to bring down his arch nemesis, Jim Baxter, and save his girlfriend. Now, as we stated before, this film was shot back to back with Day of the Panther. And it's pretty apparent when you watch this film, because let's just say, Marcy, the first 15 minutes gave me Silent Night, Deadly Night 2 flashbacks, because the first 15 minutes are literally a recap of everything that happened in the first film, and which actually surprisingly made me realize, oh, is that what happened in terms of plot?
Yeah,
of the
it
first
actually
film?
Tells you what, oh, that's what happened. I don't even think the recaps in the Friday the 13th sequels were this long. It's legit just under 15 minutes of recap of the first movie.
Exactly. And that's why, in an interesting way, you could watch Strike of the Panther without seeing Day of the Panther, because it literally is like the first film in the first 15 minutes, and then we go straight into the sequel. The question is, though, how do we compare this sequel to the first one? So, Marcy, your thoughts on Strike of the Panther?
Yeah, look, it's still a flawed film, but it definitely has the edge over Day of the Panther. And I think that's, even if it is more of the same, this one's not as messy. It adds in more cheese. For some reason, it adds in a supernatural element. And for some reason, it adds in hockey mask wearing ninjas. So you can tell it's taking itself a lot less seriously. And I think it makes it a lot more fun. And I think it's paced out a lot better, despite the first 15 minutes being a recap of the first film. And it keeps the story pretty basic. So that works. And I like that we bring back the Jim Baxter character, but then the John Stanton character, for some reason, has supernatural ability to connect to Jason Blade to help him fight people. It's ridiculously all over the place, but I think it just works overall a bit better as a film, and it's so much more silly. Like, the whole sequence where he goes into a brothel to save a young girl there, it's like, what brothel is this? There's a man in a chicken suit. There's, I can't even, like, it's just, what is this?
I'm not going to lie, Marcy, I enjoyed this one even more so than the first one, mainly because I think with the first film, Day of the Panther, knowing that Brian Trenchard-Smith came onto that film at the very last minute, so pretty much I guess he had to work with what he was given with that one. But I feel like with the sequel, though, he was given a bit more free rein to do whatever he wanted, and you could definitely sense that sort of more embracing of the silliness of the premise. This film is just completely silly from top to bottom. Like, it also does take itself seriously as well, but I think it finds a good balance of being serious enough while also being entertainingly silly at the same time.
It's not overtly, like, super serious. It, like, knows how to have some fun with it.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that there's so much weirdness in it, when you told me about the brothel scene, I thought, oh, I had a bit of an idea what you were referring to. And when the scene was unfolding, I thought, okay, it just seems like a very standard brothel scene.
It seems so at first.
And then eventually during the course of when Jason Blade is fighting off some of the bodyguards and some of them get knocked in the rooms, like you said, there was a guy in a chicken outfit. And then downstairs, he runs into another guy who's dressed up as like a schoolboy, and he runs up to Jason.
And he's a submissive schoolboy who wants to be punished by any means necessary.
And then at one point, I believe even Jason even whacks the madam as well. And also, I forgot to mention this in the first film, but I'll say it here because it is shown in the recap. One of the most amazing things in that very first film and in the shown in the recap of this one, and our good friend Simon pointed this out, in his review of the first film on Letterboxd is when the character of Baxter, played by Jim Richards, randomly pushes a woman into the pool.
Yeah. Like, what?
And it wasn't just like a normal, like, push. It was like an aggressive bam, and she went flying. And I'm like, what's going on here? And they show that scene again in the montage. And then from there, like, the silliness just keeps getting better and better. And then, of course, the great Rowena Wallace comes in at some point.
Oh, I was like, oh, shit, Rowena Wallace is in this? And she... owns it. Like,
oh yeah,
she was a good addition. Like, I'm like, you know what, I'm changing my star rating, because this movie is, it's better than the first one, and it needs a better rating than the first one. I'm just saying, it's getting a higher rating. I'm editing my letterbox as we speak.
You hear it here first, people.
Yeah,
but yeah, I thought she was great, and she actually brings a lot of, I guess, gravitas to the film, because she's playing it very seriously, but at the same time, though, she is a badass in this film. Like, she leads an entire basically SWAT team into the building. Like, yeah, most of her people are killed off by the ninjas, and I'm not gonna lie, when the ninjas and hockey masks showed up, I was not expecting it.
I was not expecting that either. I'm like, oh, we got ninjas in this movie, and then you see them wearing like colored hockey masks. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. We're embracing the fun and cheese with this film. This is what I wanted out of Day. I wanted more of this silly shit in it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But I'm glad we got it in this version. Or in this one, rather.
Even to promote one of our other shows, the sequel is totally a To Be Tuesday podcast.
Yeah, it has more, like, those kind of vibes, which I love.
but
yeah, I'm also disappointed that this one just doesn't have much of a higher rating. Some of the reviews are like quite mean. I'm like, he obviously didn't enjoy the silliness of this movie.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. And also too, which I find surprising, because I guess some people kind of preferred the more seriousness of the first one and feel like the silliness of this sequel wasn't for them. But for me, I love it when an action film embraces its silliness while at the same time playing it straight as well, without nudge, nudge, wink, wink to the camera.
Yeah, it's sort of got the tone for that stuff really well. Or the balance, I should say.
And also, you can definitely tell Brian Trenchard Smith was also inspired by what action films were at the time, because, again, ninjas were the thing in the 80s. So why not put ninjas in this movie?
Yeah, why not? And Friday the 13th had a killer with a hockey mask. So let's add hockey masks to the ninjas.
Exactly. But I really enjoyed this film. And like I said, I think Rowena Wallace was a great addition. And she was a badass throughout. And also, I think Edward John Stalzak gave a better performance in this one. It felt like he was allowed to let loose a little bit more, so he felt a bit better. But yeah, I just really enjoyed this one. And also the weird subplot where Anderson has this psychic link to Jason Blade and telling him what to do or to look out for specific
villains. Some reason, this just happens.
Exactly. And it's never even established even in the first film at all.
It comes out of nowhere. There's no explanation as to why this is a thing now. But that just adds to it being such a silly movie.
And also, I got to give a shout out. I think even though I think the first film was well shot, I think the second film is even better shot as well. Like, there's a lot of great cinematography in this one, and also has a lot more neon and just bright colors, and it just looks gorgeous. And also, from what I read, both films were shot on 16mm, then blown up to 35. So you can definitely tell that these films look really good. And also, because I own the 2-pack double feature from Umbrella of this movie, and Umbrella did 4K restorations on both these films, and I think they did a great job with their restoration work on both these
films. They both look really good with what Umbrella did. Yeah, I just think, look, at the end of the day, this one just has more fun, and it's so much less convoluted. They still have some of the same sort of issues, but I think this one just does it a little bit better.
Oh, definitely.
Overall, I think there's a bit more time put in towards the martial arts and action sequences with this as well. But yeah, they're very similar movies, obviously, because they were shot at the same time, meant to be like that. And I think Edward John Stasek was sort of meant to be like Australia's answer to a James Bond slash martial arts star that didn't quite work out. But I feel like his presence is not of a lead. I feel like he more would have been a better supporting player. But yeah, I don't like, he's great at what he does. I think he quite had the right charisma for a character called Jason Blade. But yeah, I do recommend like a Sunday arvo just watching these two back to back. Or you can just watch Strike of the Panther and get that 15-minute recap.
Exactly. But I guess that could be a wrap on our discussion of Strike of the Panther. And Marcy, your final thoughts and overall rating, or your new overall rating?
My new rating? Yeah, no, I've changed my rating now. I give it 3.5 out of 5. I think it deserves that extra half for just being as silly as it is. Again, I do recommend people check both of them out, and you can either get like 2-pack from Umbrella, or it is free on Broly if you're in Australia. So yeah, like something very different to what we have covered before. So it was nice to sort of have something slightly different.
Oh, definitely. And I'm also giving this 3.5 out of 5 as well. I really enjoyed the sequel even more so than the first one. I feel like, as we sort of stated before, it embraces more of the silliness and has some even better action set pieces. I think the performances are a little bit more stronger in this one, and having Rowena Wallace there as well is also great too. And I know Rowena Wallace is also in your heart too, Marcy, because she was also on Neighbours as well.
Of course. Anyone who's appeared on Neighbours in like even one episode, Dave Bautista. I will forever love you, because Neighbours is everything. Save Neighbours, everybody.
Exactly. And yeah, I just had an absolute ball with this one. I mean, Marcy, when you have hockey mask wearing ninjas in your movie, you definitely know I'm going to have a great time with it. Although I am a little bit sad, because apparently there was meant to be a third film in the series called Escape of the Panther, but unfortunately it never got made. So both Edward John Starzec and Jim Richards actually would go on to make another film together instead called Black Neon, which we will discuss in a future episode of this show.
I look forward to that.
So yeah, I guess that could be a wrap for this episode of the Ozboy cast. And thank you once again, Marcy, for always being a very awesome Aussie loving co-host.
You're very welcome. It's like, we cover all sorts of films, but again, it's interesting when and this goes for most episodes, just all very different, kind of similar in some ways, but still just different. And it's like a history of Australia just going through all these films. Before we wrap up properly, just to let everybody know, because we made this list of all these films almost 5 years ago. It could have been 5 years ago, I'm not sure. It's been a while. We have missed quite a number of movies as we've been trying to cover them from release order. So in upcoming episodes that will be happening this year, we will be going back to the 70s and 80s, as well as progressing through the rest of the late 80s and getting into the 90s, because we have catch up to play on quite a number of movies that we somehow missed.
Exactly. And that's the thing, though, like when I was putting the original list together, I was kind of going off from the official information I had at the time, like Wikipedia, also Not Quite Hollywood, and a few other places as well. When you really deep dive into Ozploitation, and what's considered Ozploitation, you realize, oh, there is way more than I initially thought. So yeah, that's what we're going to do over the rest of this year. Is we're going to, once we cover the 80s, we are going to go straight into the 90s period. But every few episodes, or also whether it be our every second or third episode, we'll do what we like to call our catch-up episodes, where we, as you say, go back and watch films that we missed out on from the 70s and 80s, but also we'll even add films to those episodes in which we're not sure if they're classified as Ozploitation films or not. So that can be an interesting kind of debate whether they should be or not.
Exactly. So yeah, it'll be some interesting things coming up. So yeah, definitely stay tuned. With any luck, we'll be doing this every month.
But before we wrap up the show today, Marcy, where can people find both you personally out there on the internet, and as well as this show and all our other shows on the Super Network?
Yeah, head to supermarcy.com and you can find all of our podcasts at the Super Network there, and all of our previous works and stuff like that. I should hope that you are subscribed to the Ozploit cast, but if not, you can find the Ozploit cast just by looking that up on your regular podcast players such as Spotify and Apple. And if you want to leave us a review, please do so, and we'd love to read that out on the show. And if you want the feed of all of our podcasts, there is one under the Super Network or the Super Podcast feeds as well. And you can find the Super Network on social medias as well. There's so many things. And I am available on the social media at Super Marcy. However, on Letterboxd, I am Super_Marcy. And you can see my ranking of the films we've covered so far, from the 70s in its own list, the 80s in its own list, and all the movies we've covered for the podcast.
Awesome. And if people were to find me personally out there on the internet, you can follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bede Jermaine. You can also find all my work over at supermarcy.com. And also you can listen to my solo podcast, Bede versus the Living Dead, as well as its little spin-off shows on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Bede versus the Living Dead podcast feed. So, yep, that is a wrap for this episode of the Ozploit cast. Once again, we hope you all enjoyed this one, and be back next month, in which we will be looking at 5 more Ozploitation films. And for this episode, we're going to be looking at the films which were all released in 1988, To Make a Killing, Incident at Raven's Gate, Kodaicha, The Dreaming, and Sons of Steel. So stay tuned for that episode, everyone, and we'll see you all then. See you, everyone. Bye.
Catch you later.